You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Pointless Exercise Podcast. I'm glad you enjoy it. Have you ever thought to yourself, you know, podcast is great, but I wish there was a version of it that I could read in the can. Well, you're lucky, because now there is. Actually, there has been all along, only now you could pay for it. Such a deal. But it is a deal, because the Pointless Exercise newsletter, which has gone to the subscriber model as of opening day, for a week after opening day, is running a 15% off promotion. So the $6.99 monthly fee is only $5.94, or you can do an annual, which regularly is $69.99, it's only $59.49. What a deal. Think of it as subscribing to The Athletic, but only getting the good parts. That's pointlessexercise.com. Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you doing?
Andy, doing good. Thanks. How are you?
Oh, I'm terrific.
It's the opening day eve.
Yes, opening day eve. And so now we are about to spin the wheel and figure out what the hell we're supposed to talk about for the next hour.
Well, it's what we do. Maybe it'll be a season with a particularly memorable opening day. That'll be fun.
Maybe it will be.
1994. I don't want to talk about different roads.
All right, here we go. We're going to spin the wheel. We did 1997 last time, so that has been removed. And here we go.
Is it
1992?
1992 Cubs. Okay, let's do this.
So I could tell you that. Do you remember? Although, you, as
well,
a ticket holder, you probably didn't care.
Let me start with my five fast.
Oh, that's right. What are your five fast facts about the 1992 Cubs?
1992, first year of Larry Himes. Fact number one. Fact number two, first year of Sammy Sosa as a Cub, having been acquired for George Bell in addition to Ken Patterson, 1992. Also, the last time that Sean Dunson would play a game for about 19 months, so that was fun. I'll throw in an opening day fact. Cubs beat future Cub left-hander Terry Mulholland in Old Veterans Stadium that year when Mark Grace hit a nice three-run dinger off him. Fact number five, Chuck McElroy recorded the save in that game. And that's just five random facts. Doesn't really tell you much about the season, but we may come back to them if we have to. But
the stylish Chuck McElroy. Glasses.
Yeah, Chuck was the remnant of really, I guess you would say, the Rafael Palmeiro situation as far as Jim Fry having dealt Palmeiro and Jamie Moyer. And, of course, who can forget Drew Hall? For 1 year of Mitch Williams leading the Cubs to the division. Of course, Cubs also got Paul Kilgus and Steve Wilson, Curtis Wilkerson. And but Williams, of course, flamed out, was gone. And for pennies on the dollar, Jim Fry then got Bob Scanlon and Chuck McElroy for Mitch Williams. And but for a while, Andy, let us not forget that on that glorious day in April, almost literally 19 years ago, I'm sorry,
29 years ago. Good. We're old.
When the Cubs jumped out to a 1-0 record with Chuck McElroy retiring the side in the ninth inning, and we were feeling good about Chuck at that moment.
We were.
You mentioned Bob Scanlon. All I remember about Bob Scanlon, and that wouldn't have happened in this season, because this is the great Jim Lefever.
Daydream Lefever, as Mike Murphy might tell you.
I think Jim Riggleman under hobbies on anything he's ever filled out puts telling Bob Scanlon to warm up. Bob pitched approximately 400 innings one year in the bullpen. It's like when you play baseball video game and you go to get a guy up in the bullpen and then just forget that he's there, and you check later and you realize that he's been warming up for 5 innings. And that was Riggleman in real life.
Steve Cishek.
Did you see where Cubs. Steve Cishek just landed?
I did, and I forgot.
He's an Anaheim Angel. So,
okay. Oh, he is.
I'm sure Joe won't use him at all.
Right.
Steve, do you think you got 158 games in your arm this year? Because we're going to need it.
Sure, Coach.
So what I was going to say was, do you remember? So it's a phenomenon that doesn't exist with the Cubs right now, although given their current trajectory, it may very well come back. But so you'd always sell out opening day.
Mm-hmm.
Game two, not so much.
Yep.
So old style would buy a crap load of tickets and give them away. It was the old style opener. That's what game two always was.
I went to three old style openers.
They would run a big full page ad in the Tribune, and you could just fill it out and send it in. And they said there was a lottery, but honestly, they had more tickets than they got stuff sent in. And you could request. I can't remember if you're limited to two tickets. But that you just get sent tickets, and then we'd pile in a car from NIU and head on over for freeze our ass off for game two of the season. We did it in 93 and 94, at least.
So what was their home opener? Was it the Cardinals?
Let's look at 92. The one I remember wasn't have been this year. The one I distinctly remember was against the Braves.
Jose Guzman, one hitter?
No.
No.
Because that was the opener.
No, the opener was Greg Maddux.
That was game two. We didn't go to that one then. That's probably... So that must not have been the one we... That's the one year we didn't go. But it was a game against the Braves where both Willie Wilson and Deion Sanders hit triples.
Are you sure that this might not have just been the third game of the 93 season?
Well, it could have been, but that would just ruin the story. Mike, nobody's going to look this up.
Let's see facts.
What I remember is we used to get free tickets, and we would go to early season games. So, yes, it's very possible that... But we had good seats right... basically right behind the third base dugout because there's nobody there. And watching this, like, Willie had to be 40 by then. And then Deion was not 40, but two of the fastest dudes ever hit triples. It was very impressive to watch both of them.
Deion hit a triple or Otis Nixon? It was Deion?
It was Deion.
Okay.
Yeah, I couldn't have given two shits about Otis Nixon, even though he was fast.
Right, and he just looked like a just a little literal portrait of a Native American like chief from 200 years ago.
He was a cigar store Indian.
Yeah, not the Fred McGriff type, not the one that would drop throws that were thrown your way. Sorry. So, that makes sense because even when the Cubs were bad, even before Tribune, opening day has historically been a big ticket, and then who the hell wants to sit in the shade on an April afternoon otherwise. So I was always game, though. I mean, especially as a kid, any opportunity I'd have to get out there, even if it was to see the 92 Cubs and Bob Scanlon straight as an arrow fastball.
Well, and that was no advanced bleacher tickets, so you could...
No, it was. In 92 it was.
Was it? But didn't they hold some back? You could always just... Maybe they just have enough demand. You could always show up and get some.
Yeah, the history on the bleacher tickets is that prior 1984 is the last season actually that they were day of game only, because there was outrage. I remember when Dallas Green had the nerve to start selling them in advance. As you can see, it didn't really do much to hurt the franchise. And then they didn't allow a season ticket pass. Like, of course, why would they? You know, yeah. In the 60s and 70s and 80s. Till even later than that. So you could buy your ticket, your bleachers in advance. in 92.
Ooh, we had a good old Sal opener in 92. The Cubs beat their arch rivals, the Cardinals, 5-1, behind the excellent pitching. Just two men, only took two guys to hold the Cardinals to a run. Sean Boskey, 6 2/3, four hits, one run, and Chuck McElroy, 2 1/3 for the save.
Old no school. Hits,
no walks.
Telling you, man, two strikeouts. We were on that Chuck McElroy Express in April. The man was going to lead us to the promise. We would get something for that. What was left, the remnant of the Rafael Palmeiro trade. Before I get too far, and before I forget, I'll just tell you that the Cubs ended up trading Chuck McElroy for Larry Lubbers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
the trade gets worse.
The trade that hurt both teams, Larry Lubbers for Chuck McElroy.
That's where the Rafael Palmeiro value ended.
Hey, where do you think Ryne Sandberg batted at the beginning of the 92 season?
Gee, Andy, do you think he batted second?
He did not.
Wait, really?
At least in this game against the Cardinals. Here's your batting order. Cleotha, Chico Walker leading off in left field.
Chico.
Jose Vizcaíno at shortstop. Mark Grace.
He ended up having a nice season. Uh-huh.
Ryne Sandberg at second.
Cleaning up.
Samuel Peralta Sosa playing center field.
Mm-hmm.
Dwight Smith in right field. Yeah,
oh, God.
That's a choice. Gary Dwight Scott at third base. Joe Girardi. Yes. And then this game,
yes.
Sean Boskey. And Sandberg, who was prone to slow starts, this would have yes. been game, what were they? This was game 5 for the Cubs. At the end of the game, 316, 348, 526.
An anomaly.
Well, maybe it's because right. he was hitting cleanup. That Lefevre, he was on to something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, that's – I don't remember Sandberg batting cleanup too much. I remember Bill James pointing out that had Sandberg and Grace flipped their spots, that like traditional thinking led, traditional managers to put their second baseman batting second and their, line drive hitting first baseman third, but that both would have been better served had managers flipped them. I know you're going to take a
– Sandberg didn't like hitting anywhere but second.
I heard you say that, but – I have a hard time. I mean, the guy never said a goddamn word, but maybe he got a little pissy.
You're saying he wouldn't?
I don't know.
Are you saying Ryne Sandberg wouldn't say shit if he had a mouthful? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they jerked his ass from third base to second. I don't know.
This is probably not the season for that. We probably should talk about that when we get to 83.
Yes.
But that didn't make any sense. It really didn't. I mean, I know because he would have been a gold glove third baseman. It wasn't that he had to play second base to be a gold glover. He was an incredible fielder. And they, at the time, there were more good second basemen than there were third basemen. And the Cubs had this gaping hole over there at third that I know that they plugged the fucking penguin in. That's why they did it.
But it's not like they had any second baseman that Sandberg was blocking.
They had Bump Wills.
Bump Wills was their second baseman.
How can you block Bump Wills?
Bump Wills would fall over if he had to like move laterally.
Was Mike Tyson still around?
No, the white Mike Tyson, finally bats? Gone. Joe Strain, they gave Joe Strain a try after trading Jesus Figueroa for him prior to 81. No,
when did they bring Manny Trio back?
Trio back, but he was too old to play second.
No, not a Manny different Trio. Player. He could still play it today.
Manny came back in 86 and played third and played outfield and he would step in at second. But I think Sandberg, what made Sandberg special as a second base, and we can talk about this because he was kind of still in his peak, although maybe beginning the downside in 92. But defensively, what made him special and unique was his sort of range and this sort of like this ESP-ish thing that Javi sometimes shows where he was just always in good position. And I don't know how helpful the range is to third. The quickness, was he also as quick? I mean, would he have been as great of a third baseman? I never considered it before, so I'm sort of thinking out loud. You said it, and I'm just wondering if that's,
the case. It's all I ever think about.
Is that right?
It is. I'm obsessed. Why did they move you, Ryan?
It would be one thing if, like, they had, I don't know, I don't know if Sandberg even had a contemporary.
Is it because Ken Hubbs died? Is that why they had to move? I don't quite remember the years. 62, is that right? Ken Hubbs would have only been in his first season.
He won the rookie of the year in 62, but he died, I believe, after the 63 season. So he didn't die. I don't think he died immediately after his rookie of the year season.
Okay, so in 1992, Ryan Sandberg played a fair amount of games batting second, third, and cleanup. He also batted seventh once, but that clearly he was pinch hitting for somebody. He hit not well at all cleanup. In 29 games, 119 plate appearances, 229, 319 on base, 381 slugging.
Okay, a month's worth.
Four homers and 15 RBIs, and they said, all right, that's enough of that shit. Batting third, he was very good. He hit 322, 372, 510 in 226 plate appearances, six homers and 31 RBIs. But when they had him bat second, he was very good. 319, 390, 556 slugging, 16 homers, 41 RBIs. So apparently Ryan knew what he was doing, and that was bat me second. I'm unstoppable when he hit me there. Now, part of it, this is the disadvantage of us just pulling this out of our ass as we do it. If those cleanup appearances mostly happened early in the year, he never hit early in the year.
No correct. He actually almost outperformed his usual April. He used to.
But that was only five games. Who knows where? Well, I could probably look it up.
Well, it's five games to start the season. We said he ended up having. Oh yeah, 29. What did you say? 29 games or 29 at bats?
29 games.
Yeah. So they obviously weren't consecutive, but they probably, I'm going to guess, the preponderance of it might have been early on, and he was struggling like he always did. And
so here's his OPS by month: April and March, 755. May, 829, June, 831, July, 893, August, 800, September, 1.119. In 129 plate appearances in September, Sandberg hit 10 homers with 23 RBIs.
Yeah. It was right around the time that he had been made the highest paid player of the game, surpassing Bobby Bonilla. Which I think the contract was to begin the following season, or I don't know how that worked. The other thing I'll say about Sandberg in 1992, he was still a really good defensive player. I mean, he was, you know, he was a surprisingly good offensive player from a position that had not for a long time really seen a whole lot of that type of sort of power production, power and speed out of that. But he was, by leagues, he was just a ridiculously good defensive second baseman. I pointed out he's one of only two second basemen in baseball history to have had six seasons of 500 assists, Charlie Gehringer being the other one. He won a gold. Now, gold gloves are subjective, of course, but beginning in 84, he won it every single year through 91. And I remember, because I'm a provincial Cubs fan, getting extremely butthurt about Jim Leland's open, you know, dissing of Sandberg and talking up his second baseman, Chico Leand
won the gold glove.
And Chico Leand won the gold glove in 1992.
Did he win it because he jumped over Joe Garagiola's head? Is that
all I can tell you is that as I watched the 1992 NLCS rooting for Pittsburgh, when they almost came back from a 3-1 series deficit and were leading late with Doug Drabeck on the hill, that Jim Leland's beloved Chico Leand, his little mascot, somebody he was more worried about winning the goddamn gold glove than a freaking pennant, booted a ball in the ninth inning, which ultimately led to Francisco Cabrera's lead-changing walk-off series-ending hit. So, fuck you, Jim Leland. Right. Fuck you, Chico Leand.
And Sandberg never did that. Now, a ball may have hit a rock and bounced over his head.
Yeah, well, that was just... That wasn't shit, his shit fault. Shit was going weird in San Diego, man. You could all feel it, you know, ever since from the point that Garvey hit the homer, even when the Cubs went up 3-0 on Sunday. That's all I'm going to say.
Right, so he won the Gold Glove 11 years in a row.
Yeah, 84 to 11 years in a row. Oh, right, he won it in 83. Like I said, he was the first player in history to win a gold glove in his first season in a new position when he moved to second, which will be mentioned again when we talk about 83.
Well, now he did play second base in 1982, but only 24 games.
Couple games,
133 at third.
And, of course, like a lot of second basemen, he was brought up as a shortstop.
He wins it in 91. He makes only four errors in the entire season. In 92, he doubles his errors to eight. And you're like, holy shit, that'd be the worst year ever. But it's not. And errors are not a function of... A guy with no errors doesn't mean he's a good fielder. It could also mean he never gets to anything.
Well, yeah, you have to factor range.
Sandberg had, the first year he won the Gold Glove, he had 13 errors. In 85, mm-hmm. he had 12. In 87 and 88, he had 10 and 11. Right. So 8 was not an outlier. That didn't mean he wasn't any good anymore.
No, you're talking over 800 chances. He's getting 800 grounders. Yeah. On average, it's kind of a wide range.
And then he went an entire 162 games, right, without a throwing error?
He did.
Which is amazing for a second baseman, considering how many blind throws you make on double plays. They should just never throw one away. And it doesn't hurt to have Mark Grace over there if you do get offline.
And and I don't know if Durham was part of it. Durham was actually error in game 5 in 84, notwithstanding a very good first baseman also. So, yeah, it was pretty much the last real good season for Sandberg. So what happened in 93 when he was like this highest, one of the highest paid players in or Bonds had surpassed him by then. He, in the very first spring training game, Mike Jackson threw the two inside, broke his wrist, and he wasn't able, he got a late start and, a little bit out of sorts. And then 94, it was kind of it. 92 is really the last full season that we had to appreciate the greatness that was Ryan Sandberg. go ahead.
I was going to say the other, maybe we're not ready to switch it, but the other big story in 1992 was the arrival of the guy with, at the time, the worst haircut in Major League Baseball, Sammy Sosa.
Samuel Peralta?
Yes. Coming over from the White Sox, where... Do you know what his claim to fame with the White Sox was? It's
just
a statistical anomaly, is what it is.
I recall him hitting two homers on opening day, and I only know that because the moment I stepped off of the elevator on the fourth floor in 4D in Grant North in April of 91, that the Sox fan dudes that were in the room right off the elevator were almost waiting for me. Absolutely hit it. Let me know right away that Sammy had hit two home runs for the Sox on opening day. I'm sure your fact is far more interesting.
So the season, well, two seasons before the trade, so 1990, Sammy, in his first full year with the White Sox, was the only big leaguer, maybe ever, but it's certainly that year, to have double digits, doubles, triples, homers,
errors,
stolen bases, caught stealings, grounded into double plays, and errors. Now that's a full season. You are really getting it done if you can get 10 or more of all of those things. Because it was a big deal in 84 when Sandberg had, he had the homers and the doubles and the stolen bases and 19 triples.
Sometimes people get a little too geeked out about the stats. Like there's another one about, the Sandberg one was a 300 batting average, 20 homers, 20 triples, 40 doubles, and 100 RBIs or something. He was one short on the triples and the homers of hitting this mark. Another one was at one point Andre Dawson was so many guys to have had bat 300 with 300 steals or, it's nice, but not.
I may have shortchanged Sammy because another category he had double digits in, which may be part of the set, was assists.
Yes,
so
of course.
As an outfielder, he had 14 assists and 13 errors.
Yeah, he was aggressive.
His plus minus was, he was plus one. That boy, Sammy.
Yeah. He was a wild child. He was basically a prospect with a lot of potential that ultimately panned out, and it panned out for the Cubs, but he was always an exciting player. So let's take a dive into 1992, Sammy, because there's some fun things there. It is his first season with the Cubs. He gets traded on the eve of the season by Larry Himes, who himself was somewhat infatuated with Sosa. He had traded, I can't believe I'm going to say this, Hall of Famer Harold Baines for Sosa, which is ironic that Sammy's not a Hall of Famer and Baines is. That's a whole topic for a whole nother discussion. But Sosa had played a little bit for Texas. He was a hot prospect. Himes had him targeted, and he played a lot for the Sox, had some success, had some serious failure, really bottomed out, I think, in 91. George Bell was one of only three, of the three big free agent signings that Jim Frey had signed in 91, Bell was actually the only one who was somewhat worth the deal and had a nice season. So it was a little bit of a surprise when the Cubs traded him for Sosa, because Sosa was still really all potential. He had shown some flash, but you got to see both the good and the bad in that season. You talked about the old style game, the second home game of the season. I want to say the game before on the home opener, I want to say that Sammy threw out a runner from center tagging up to send the game into extra innings. You know, he had that flair. The real high point was, though, he was an everyday player. He played center. I think he settled into right pretty quickly, but he got hit. I want to say, I can't remember the pitcher who hit him, but he got it, or I don't know if he got hit, but he got, he spent some time on the DL. He was out for about a month.
He only played 67 games for the Cubs that year.
For the whole season. Yeah. And so he got injured sort of early, and then the Cubs sort of floundered, but somehow they were like alive in late July. And Sosa had just come off the DL, and Pittsburgh was coming to town, and the Pirates had won two consecutive National League East divisions, and they would eventually win a third. But the Cubs going into the series were 46-51, a fact that I remember for reasons that I'll get into later. And Sosa was back in the first game. Maddux outdueled Drabek. And, you know, like I said, the Cubs are about 7 or 8 games behind July. It's behind Pittsburgh. It's late July. But Sosa, I want to say Sosa led off the series, the homer. He homered, I think he was batting leadoff, bottom of the first. He homers, and the Cubs held on. Jeff Robinson gets the save. The next day, they end up blowing them out. I think Steve Buschel hit for the cycle.
Oh, of course he did.
Right? And the Cubs are going for the sweep the next day. Sosa had sort of cooled off, though. And in this game, the Cubs are down. I want to say they're down 4-0. I think Frank Castillo started, but they came back. They tied the game, and it went to extras. And Sosa came up a couple of times in a huge situation to win the game, and he struck out. But then ultimately, off of Stan Belinda in like the 14th inning or whatever, he went yard. The Cubs swept the series. They were only 49-51. But let me tell you, Andy, you might remember this. Cubdom was in bedlam, and we were all going nuts. I think we're all guilty of it. It took the late great Mike Royko of you know who else the very next day to take all of us to task. In a legendary article that I believe you can find the text from if you Google Mike Royko Cubs 49-51 1992, where he takes the Cubs to task, the Cubs fans to task for we're going out of our mind. I remember calling. I was in Northern. It was in the summer, but I was still working up there, calling my brother, like, this is incredible. We were still sort of like trying to relive that excitement from 84 and 89. It was too few and far between, and all of a sudden here's this Sammy Sosa that's just like kind of on fire, and the Cubs are going to hunt down the Pirates. And then you read this article by Royko, and god damn it if he wasn't right once again. And it was just, he put it in the proper perspective. You know, you guys are being idiots. The Cubs are 49-51, and sure enough, it faded. What happened with him about a week later, Sosa was batting again at home, I think, against Wally Whitehurst of the Mets. This is where he got injured by a pitch. Whitehurst, I believe, broke his wrist, pretty much knocked him out of the season. Cubs kind of faded out. But that, you know, to me, when I think of Sammy Sosa 92, like, it was easy to sort of get attracted to the sort of electricity that he had. And then also, you know, see his flaws too. He was, you know, he was exciting, but you could see it 92. He obviously a different player later, but the essence was still there.
Yeah. Sammy, his approach to the game at the time was, Lou Holtz, when Jarius Jackson was the quarterback for Notre Dame, said that Jarius plays like he's trying to win the game for both teams at the same time. And that was Sammy. It was, he was going to make something happen, whether it was good or bad. Now, as I missed part of your narration of the bottom of the 11th, as I was looking it up, did you point out that there was a runner on base when Sammy hit the home run? And who it was? And how he got there?
The game was tied. I would have no memory of that. Okay. I was blinded by the Sosa bomb. What do you got for me?
Okay, so Stan Belinda was in pitching, and yep. Ray Sanchez led off, and he struck out looking, much to the chagrin of all the fans there. And so the Cubs, obviously dealing with the bullpen was getting a little tired. Paul Aussenbacher was allowed to hit for himself.
Oh!
And he walked on 4 pitches.
Terrific. Stan Belinda, just to stop, just to put it in perspective of maybe the younger of us, Stan Belinda was sort of like this, probably a token of heartbreak for Pirates fans. He was, they were trying to make him their closer. You know, the Pirates won three straight divisions and they lost three straight LCS, once to the Reds, twice to the Braves. One of their problems is, besides Barry Bonds not showing up in any of those three postseasons, was they never really had a reliable closer. And Belinda was kind of like their last great hope.
Yep.
And as we already have sort of gone over,
he got Francisco Cabrera.
And that was later on that season, yep. Right? So,
The pitchers that day for the Pirates were Bob Walk, who Pat Hughes, I'm sure, was somewhere
in Milwaukee still,
talking about how you can't have a pitcher named Walk. Roger Mason, who blew the save. Denny Nagel out of the bullpen for an inning, and then Stan Belinda for 2 1/3. Trying to get three innings out of him and couldn't. For the Cubs that day, Frank Castillo only went three.
Yep.
Ken Patterson.
Rick Wilson hit a homer in that game too.
Ken Patterson, okay. The gem in the trade for George Bell.
Yep.
Two more innings out of Chuck McElroy. Gave up one hit and nothing else.
Chuck.
Jeff Robinson apparently pitched two innings for the Cubs that day.
Jeff and then, had gotten the save on Monday. He might have been.
And then the Paul Assmaker, as Harry would maybe not accidentally call him from time to time.
Yeah.
But that win pulled the Cubs to win 3.5 games on the 29th of July.
With a 49-51 record.
Well, that doesn't matter. Royko. There's no maximum or minimum number of games you got to win. You just got to win more than everybody else. But yes,
I know. But yeah,
he was right because this was not a good Cub team, and it was. And the I don't know what how the Pirates finished, but they easily won the division. They
did.
They weren't sweating it out in July, although it was at the trade deadline, so maybe it spurred them to action to get somebody.
They would win their third straight. That was the end of it, though. That was their last hurrah before. They burped up again about 10 years ago. But you mentioned Ray Sanchez. I want to get this out of the way because I know it happened in 1992, watching it in my apartment in Stadium View in DeKalb.
One of the great moments of Cub history.
Ray Sanchez, which, you know, sort of an ordinary player, but he'll always have a place in my heart when he hung in there. The bases loaded in the tie game in the home half of the last inning, whether it was the ninth or extras, I can't remember, but the fearsome Rob Dibble was on the mound, and Dibble threw a pitch a little too close inside, and Ray Sanchez just managed to hang in there long enough to get the game-winning HBP.
That you were going to say this was the season where the guy hit the pop-up, and Harry goes, Sanchez, under it. He's never dropped one of these in his life, and then he dropped it.
Yes, that was Ray Sanchez, right? That Harry, yep. Okay.
He's never, and Harry laughed. He thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. It's like, well, we got to entertain ourselves somehow, Harry.
I also have to bring this up now because I don't want to forget, and also it's probably going to be worthy of discussion because I just realized this happened in 1992, and had I been more prepared, this would have been one of my five facts, but there was a game against the Mets in June or July of 1992 when the Cubs were about 40 feet from winning a game until a sniper on the roof of the Wrigley Field upper deck fired a bullet into Cal Daniels' right hamstring, causing Daniels to crumple into the ground and fall short. Or at least that's what I always thought happened, is that a sniper took out Cal. All I know is that Jose Vizcaino, the aforementioned Jose Vizcaino, ropes a double into the right field corner, and good old Cal Daniels was chugging his hardest, is coming around third, and I think he was shot, but he stumbled. There's a it's out there. John Dooley was able to help me to find it a year ago on Twitter, and somebody helped me convert it to a GIF. So if I find it, I'll get it. But anybody that was alive back then wouldn't need to see it as a reminder, because never forget Cal Daniels.
So do you know what Cal Daniels' real first name is?
It's not Calvin.
It is not. It is his name. This is ridiculous. His name is Kalvoski Daniels. He named him after a guy he served with in the military whose last name was Kalvoski. Couldn't you have named your kid after whatever the guy's first name was? Maybe it was Dan. Maybe it was Dan Daniels. It couldn't be Dan Daniels. So he named him Cal. His name is Kalvoski Daniels.
How about that?
And Cal, at one point, was a hell of a player. But by the time the Cubs got him, He was not.
He had injuries, and I actually
had terrible, lots of leg injuries, and it was a combination of that and, you know, the old Wrigley Field, the actual surface, had that weird slope for water drainage purposes.
And yes, it was.
Cal was not the first guy who biffed it round in third base because all of a sudden you were running down a ditch on your way. You're running forward, and the grass is.
Wait a second.
The earth is falling off to your right as you're running.
Hold on a minute. This I've never heard before. I always knew that for the longest time Wrigley had some terrible irrigation and just turf.
So the Cubs are in the third base dugout, and I distinctly remember, I think it was probably Dusty complaining that when you're in, this was before, I don't know what year they evened the surface out finally.
Couldn't remember.
But when you were standing in the third base dugout, you could not see entire players' bodies on the field. You'd like only see their head because you were so much lower than they were, the way the field sloped up away from you to get out onto the field.
If you were sitting down either foul line or down first,
he said in the Cub dugout, like you would, like if you were looking at Sammy in right field, you didn't see all of Sammy. You only saw like his head.
Right. Because
you were looking uphill at him. There was a lot of shit wrong with that. Yeah. State. There still is, but there's a lot less than there used to be.
Okay, so I retract the sniper theory.
Well, no, but it didn't happen every time. So, and Cal was a Cub, and he'd been a Red. He'd played there enough. He should have probably figured that out. The same thing happened to the great Todd Pratt once. Do you remember that?
I just remember
he was
Todd
about
Pratt
to score the easiest run of his life to win the game for the Cubs. Just fell flat on his face, got tagged out.
I don't remember that one. So, okay.
It's the only thing I remember about Todd Pratt. I know he went to play for the Phillies later, but I didn't give a shit.
Mine is Cale Daniels, and I think there was some justification for. Obviously, a team is not very good if you'll have comes down to a guy making it home in a game in late June. But I want to say that the Cubs were sort of, you know, doing okay, kind of alive, maybe on a roll. And honestly, I know maybe statisticians say there's no merit in this, but it kind of felt like the type of loss that. I'm going to find it now as I'm scrolling, but the type of loss that really can sort of sink a team or just, you know, spin them in the other direction.
So you mentioned the George Bell trade. Do you remember what one of Jim Fry's was Himes, but I don't even know why I brought up one of the reasons for the motivation to trade George Bell at the time that they did.
Let's see here.
Remember that he arrived a little late for spring training, and why?
He had a gas station?
Yes, right. He was running his gas station in the Dominican. And, you know, business was booming, and he couldn't, he wasn't sure he needed an entire spring training. And the Cubs,
so
Himes was looking for an excuse to trade him because he wanted Sammy.
When we talked about 1997, about Jaime Navarro, how we got two good years out of him and he was terrible for the Sox, I will have to say, George Bell, we had one good year out of him, and the Sox got one good year out of him. But then when they went to the division in 93, he had rendered himself useless. So there, I think he was just about checked out. So that adds up.
Well, yeah, he really wasn't. Like, he had no business being in the outfield. So him going to DH somewhere made perfect sense. Then part of the issue they had with the Sox was they also got Bo Jackson, so they had a guy with one leg. And then they had George, and he had to play one of those two in the outfield. Great roster construction by Ron Shuler.
Well, and that was a team, though, whose core was essentially built by Himes, and that was the same reason that the Cubs had pursued him. So if we just stop for a minute, just to put it in the historical context, because last week in 1997, I kept using this term designed by mediocrity, which I characterize that as the years between beginning in 1992 and running through basically 2006, it was probably the largest chunk of the Tribune ownership, but the first 10 years of Tribune ownership from 82 until 91, they were in it to win it. They were investing in the team. They were investing in the farm system and sort of realized after Jim Fry overspent for Danny Jackson and Dave Smith and yes, George Bell that, you know, we don't have to, you know, and Jim Fry didn't have a farm system to show for it because he had burned Dallas Greens to the ground. treatment company was like, let's be a little more cautious about this free agency thing because the ballpark's filling up anyway. And it was the period of time when they really sort of leveraged, you know, with the McDonough machine at 1060 West Addison. They were going to generate a certain amount of revenue as long as the team was somewhat mediocre and maybe would sometimes have a chance to compete. Well, 1992 is really kind of the first year of doing that. So they bring over Himes. Because, hey, this guy built the farm system in the White Sox. And 4 years in a row, 87 through 1990, drafted Jack McDowell, who for at least a half a decade was one of the top five or six pitchers in the American League, for sure. The next year, Robin Ventura was one of the finest third basemen in the American League, Hall of Famer Frank Thomas, and then Alex Fernandez, who was also a very good pitcher while he was healthy early on. All four were key contributors to the 93 team. Because Larry Himes was such an acerbic asshole that was hard to get along with, in spite of his his success in cultivating the farm system, was shown the door after the 91 season.
We talked about one of the reasons Himes got fired was he traded Harold Baines, and Jerry never forgave him for it. So he was just looking for a reason to can him. And then, yeah, everybody thought Larry was an asshole. So it made it pretty easy to move
another
on
thing,
from him.
Another thing that might have helped engender that idea was I remember that at one point when he was – this is in the 80s, right, late 80s, where he banned alcohol in the clubhouse after the game. And I remember his Carlton Fisk's choice quote after. Was like, what the hell are we going to do, sit around, eat pizza, and drink Sprite? So, yeah, the guy had a stick up his ass. He was not a – which would have been fine if he succeeded for the Cubs, but he was an absolute failure. His draft, we mentioned Brooks Kieschnick last year. That was one of his draft picks. So he did not repeat the magic that he had Chicago. However, his one legacy, which, if nothing else, really kind of helped propel this sort of design by mediocrity, right? This sort of not only having a ballpark that's going to be somewhat full, you might be competitive, but having one or two or three marquee players, whether it's Sandberg or Grace or Sosa, that you can kind of rally around. So he did bring Sosa into the organization and didn't really give up a lot. And eventually Sosa became what he was. That's pretty much the only thing Larry Himes can hang his hat on.
Well, and his two trades for Sosa were both worked out for the team because the first trade, the Harold Baines trade, was Baines and Fred Manrique to the Rangers nice for call. Sammy and Wilson Alvarez.
Who threw a no-hitter for the side. And he was in that rotation in 93 with McDowell and Fernandez when they went to the playoffs. Right.
And then, obviously, the Cub trade, 1991 All-Star. George Bell. Do you want to know what 1991 All-Star George Bell's numbers were for the Cubs?
Wait, we're talking 1992.
Well, I know, but he gets traded after the 91 season.
He was a Cub All-Star.
285, 323, 468, 25 homers, and 86 RBIs. And he never took to hitting in Wrigley Field. I just lost his home road splits. He was a much better hitter on the road.
Okay.
Yeah, and he also did not have a very good second half.
Okay.
So I think the Cubs by then were like, all right, if someone will take him, we will gladly give him.
And like I said, there was a shift in Fry was cooked. When those free agents, and Bell did not flop, the team did, and a lot was hinging on Danny Jackson and Dave Smith, and there was nothing to show for the farm system, and it was the end of the chapter. That was end of Tribune One. Jim Fry, you're gone. Don Granesco would be sort of he was sort of like the co-GM, but clearly he was like this sort of Tribune, like Crane Kenny type of
Don Dennis, Zimmer.
Dennis
loved it.
Simons. Yes, right. Well, Zimmer got fired in 91. It drew the remnants of the Dallas Green, what was even left of it, was basically closed shut after 91. It was like a new era, and they embarked on this 15-year run. Pretty much rode it out until they sold the team to Sam Zell, where, again, they strive for the middle, and they might get hot or they might be awful. 92 was kind of like the standard season. They got a white, nondescript manager named Jim. What did they finish in 92? They went probably like 77 and 84, something somewhere along those lines. It was so down the middle, it was almost perfectly executed. They were not in contention probably by Labor Day, but they were throughout the – they were until Cal Daniels got thrown out home on July, the first day of July 1992, because at that point the Cubs would have been 500 – would have crawled their way up to 500 on July 1st. And I think that after that, they sort of went on a skid. So
yeah, they were 78 and 84.
That's what they finished.
Which means we know what they were in 93. They had to be 84 and 78 because Jim LaFever finished 162 and 162 in his.
Which shows you what an idiot Larry Himes was. And this is not to defend Jim LaFever. I did not think he was anything special as a manager, but the Cubs did rally around him in September of 93 and finished 500 for the first time in a non-playoff season in over 20 years. And most importantly and functionally, he had been Larry Himes' first hire as a GM, which, you know, you fire your first hire, you're one step closer to being shown the door yourself. And so in spite of the opposition to everybody, Larry Himes just had to be an asshole. He fired LaFever, and then things got worse, and then he was shown the door. And
well, he hired the electric Jim Riggleman.
No, Tom Treblehorn.
Oh, that's right. Shit, you just said it.
Yeah, there was a,
oh, God,
there was a
that's
space
right.
between the two gyms.
Oh, that's right, because... Well,
94 is special. We must save 94.
Right, because Riggleman got hired during the strike, right?
No, Riggleman would have, yeah.
Didn't he? Yeah, he got hired with no team. Hey, guys!
Well, and then the other thing I thought about, and I know this might be irrelevant if somebody ever listens to these in sequence, but since we talked about 97 last week and you pointed out that Brian McCray had been acquired like April 5th, 95, I realized afterwards because the season didn't start till late April in 95 because it was still the effects of the strike. They only played like 144 games that season and started later. And that's why Jim Riggleman... Well, you know, they started later, but you're right. You got hired. They didn't have a team. They're going to go into that season with strike players.
So in 92, Mark Grace had a very Mark Grace season. He hit 307, 380 on base, 430 slugging, 37 doubles, 9 homers.
Yeah.
An excellent first base, but...
He was. I always liked Grace. I think Cub fans tend to overrate him out of nostalgia, maybe. But very good player, man. And he was kind of entering his peak. He was actually, if you look at his stat lines, he was coming off a couple of rough years. You know, he kind of burst onto the scene in 88, rookie of the year, runner-up to Sable. 89, he actually out-hit Will Clark in that LCS.
He was amazing in the playoffs that year.
He was fantastic. But like in around 90, 91, his numbers dropped off. I think he was going through a divorce to the future Mrs. Ray Liotta. And I think he was just hitting the bars. And wasn't able to, you know, kind of keep it within the lines, but he got his act together,
yeah,
I think, by 92.
Smoking 3 packs of Winston's a day and living with a radio producer from WGN.
Dan. Imagine
Dan
being
Filato,
a Filato. Yep.
Hanging out, bringing Slump Busters home. And
well, I'm a...
Part
I'm
of the things that most endeared him to Cub fans, other than hitting lots of doubles and being a great defensive first baseman, were probably the things that kept him from actually... becoming the player he should have been.
Maybe, but it is baseball, right? I mean, would being any healthy, I mean, maybe as far as sleep deprivation, I don't know.
Okay, so if we switch the two, if Sammy is just smoking and drinking, and Grace is doing steroids.
Okay.
What is Mark Grace end up hitting? 398 with 85 home runs? I mean, it turned a Mark McGuire, a, you know, very average, especially at that point of his career, was bad into a star again.
Well, and you know, the other thing is too that the Cubs were still playing about 60 day games at home.
Yeah, it was a lot of very hungover at-bats.
I mean, you know, it's not a long now. There is some benefit because, like, they all have a nightlife. I'm sure ball players go out after games at night, and that could get dangerous because it gets late. But you're almost compelled to go out when you're done working at 5. So,
well, you know, so Trevor Bauer has been doing this annoying thing where to challenge himself, he's been pitching with one eye closed.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how many at bats Grace took with one eye closed, not on purpose. Just like
the old
Mickey
man.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, he started to get his act. I think he still sort of, he didn't give up the lifestyle. He just sort of got a handle on it,
yeah,
or at least
just
let
got good
it
at
not
it.
Affect not affect his ball
like
playing.
Like so. Rod Beck, you just
right,
you, know, you get used to it and you can all of a sudden perform.
Right, you can't pull fat. Rod Beck's quote, but yeah. So 92, Grace had started to get his act together, and he was one of the, you know, finer left-handed hitting hitters, I guess, through the decade.
So you mentioned it a little bit, and I lived it too. Now, I mentioned in a previous podcast that when I was joking about not knowing who the White Sox existed until I got to college, it was only a slight exaggeration. But so I had a lot of friends.
Well, I can see you're a fine connoisseur of podcasts because you're here at the Pointless Exercise Podcast. And I'm not sure which podcast you're listening to, although I probably could customize this commercial to all of them, but I'm not going to do that. So I'm going to give you a quick rundown of the current podcast lineup, pointlessexercise.com, to make sure you're not missing anything. First of all, there's the award-winning Cubs podcast that I've been doing for years. The lineup changes all the time, but unfortunately, you're always stuck with me. This year, same guys are back from last year, Sam Fells from Deadspin and Kyle Reichert from Wisconsin, and now he lives in Chicago. Then there's a couple of newish podcasts. There's Remember This Crap with Mike Donahue. If you haven't heard this, oh, you're in for a treat. We put Mike's encyclopedic memory for banal events in Chicago sports history, especially the Cubs and the Bears, to the test. We are going to try to hit every Cubs season between 1980 and 2011 at some point during this. So tune in. It's a lot of fun. We throw out a year, and we just start remembering crap. And then, as if that's not enough, there's the Movie Deep Dive podcast with actor, comedian, and our bear expert, which has nothing to do with this podcast, Mike Pusateri, where we pick some of our favorite movies, and we do exactly what it sounds like. We dig deep into it. We dig up sound clips. We talk about the cast. We talk about the directors. We talk about how the movie got made, and we talk about our favorite parts in the movies. So that's plenty of podcasts, and you only have to go to one place to find them. That's pointlessexercise.com.
At Northern, who were White Sox fans. And so my first year there, they would go on about, oh, we love Sammy, and I would make fun of Sammy so like he wouldn't believe. You know, this wild, undisciplined, throw the ball halfway up the backstop. And then all of a sudden, you know, at the end of spring training, 1992, he's mine. And I had to become the biggest Sammy Sosa defender of all time. And I did. I embraced him with both arms. He was my guy now. It's like, you can't, especially with Sean getting hurt. That was all I had, was Sammy.
Yep. Next one up.
So I became a huge defender. And that game you referenced, my friend Neil, who was a
Which
big
one?
Sox fan, the Stan Belinda home run.
Yep.
We're in my car. He'd come up to visit. We were headed up to Wisconsin to go drinking somewhere. And we're listening to it in the car. It was the afternoon game.
Yeah.
And Sammy hits the home run, and I'm just, you know, I'm giving
it
to
him. We were all going nuts. Uh-huh.
You know, hey, fun with George Bell.
Oh, that's perfect. You were with him when it happened?
Yes, we were in the car listening to it. He's like, son of a bitch. As soon as he could tell, you know, would that have been Brenneman?
It's the best and the worst. In 92, it would have been Brenneman. He was there from 90 to 95, yep. Yeah, Brenneman would have called the walk-off with Ronnie bellowing. Yep. I think Brenly was gone by then. So, okay. Yeah. Yeah, Sammy had a flair, man. He showed it then. He was a different player later on. But, you know, like you said, he only played 67 games. That team was they had some good players. Was Dawson still on the team? And yeah, he was, right? Hawk? It was his last year as a Cub, 92. Yep. Moment of silence for Andre Dawson's career as a Cub.
He basically had the same year that George Bell had the year before. 277, 316, 456, 22 homers, 90 RBIs. It's not a bad year, but, you know, I don't know how many. He played 143 games. A normal human with his knees probably would have played 22 games. He played 143.
Right. And that tells me that Sosa must have been their primary center fielder.
Because he missed so many games. The guy who played the most center field, Doug DeCenzo.
This
is primo. The guys on this team, I mean, there are some beauties. This was the end of Joe Girardi's first tour with the Cubs.
He was a charter member of the Colorado
Rockies.
He
lost in the expansion draft.
Oh no!
But
you know what?
To Don Baylor's Rockies.
Rick Wilkins was waiting in the wings with a 30 home run, 40 RBI season.
It came out of nowhere and then went right back to nowhere.
Yes.
Yes, Ray Sanchez got the most starts at short, but Dunston played 18 games, and Vizcaíno played 86 games of second base and shortstop.
Yeah, we mentioned Dunston when we talked about 1997. I made it one of my five facts that he was their opening day shortstop still, and then that's when he must have gotten hurt early
on.
Picking up the car seat.
Fucking Sean Jr.
And was out for a whopping 18 months and really altered his career. I mean, yeah.
So another reason to trade George Bell was the hotshot prospect who was going to take over left field for the next 10 years.
Don't tell me. Don't tell me. In 1992?
Yep.
Kevin Roberson?
No. Son of a former big leaguer. Nice, smooth, left-handed swing. That's about all he had.
Son of a former big leaguer, left-handed swing. I'm going to have to look. Just tell me.
Derek May.
Oh, yeah. It was Derek May's finest season as a Cub in 92. He won a game by hitting like a three-run tie-breaking homer either in the bottom of the eighth or something off of Dennis Martinez of the Dodgers Wrigley Field.
Derek May is the kind of guy who a scout would see and just drool over because he was he was tall, kind of lanky, had this beautiful swing. He really had a great swing, and
he looked like a good ball player.
He could never hit for power, ever.
I guess homers, not.
He had eight homers that year,
and that I'm fairly sure. So that's his best
with 11 doubles.
Okay,
19 extra base hits in 124 games.
124
playing left field. Okay, that's not going to work.
Well, he did power one out against Denny Martinez, and for a brief while, just like I did with Chuck McElroy, boy, I had some hope for Derek May. Who was his father? Was it Carlos or Lee? There's a handful of Mays.
Dave.
Not all of them are related. Neither Carlos or Lee brothers. Okay.
Dave May, a former... he was an Oriole, a Brewer, a Brave, a Ranger. He played 12 years in the big leagues. Hit 251. Did he hit more homers than his kid? 96 homers, I think he did. I think he hit more than Derek did.
Okay. Derek hung around, I want to say, to about 96, 97. Now with the Cubs. I think he was gone probably
Derek played 10 years. Played for the Cubs, the Brewers, the Astros, and then short stints with the Phillies, Expos, and Orioles. Hit 52 home runs in 10 years.
Got it.
6'4". 210, 52 home runs. Hit the ball in the air. He hadn't heard a launch angle. If the Cubs had got a hold of him now in the hit lab, he's 30 homers. He's 30 homers a year.
Oh, no doubt.
Just born 20 years too soon. Too late. Too soon? Too soon. He's only 4 years older than me, so I probably should stop talking about
ripping out of. Yeah, probably still made enough too, and has a pension.
20 years too soon. Yeah, it was the last vestiges of some of the some of our favorite 98 Cubs. Luis Salazar was still around.
89 Cubs, you mean?
89. Oh, I say 98. 89. Dwight Smith.
Yeah, you know,
games before he went off to the Braves and actually carved out a nice niche as an extra outfielder.
Yeah, if I could say a word about Dwight Smith, I'll be granted plenty of opportunity when those years come up.
Right,
but
he will dominate. They'll have a big part of the 98.
Yeah, 89. I love Dwight 89. Smith.
I keep saying that.
You just get him transposed. It's cool. I love Dwight Smith in 89. He was the runner-up, of course, rookie of the year, second straight runner-up after Grace. And, of course, his teammate was the rookie of the year. Walton had a great season, but I just loved Smith's bat. He was really beautiful left-handed swing. He was an absolute, and I didn't know it at the time, but I'd get to see it in seasons like 92 and 93 when I swear he got a lot of starts in center, if you can believe that. Just a very atrocious outfielder. Yeah, he was terrible. super fast, but he couldn't run the bases, so it was rendered useless. He would run into outs. So his speed was moot, and it didn't help him with his defense. Just a great hitter. And you're right. The Braves kind of fashioned him into just a lefty bat off the bench because he always had a nice swing. Another fun fact about Dwight Smith, of course, were his pipes.
Yes.
And his ability to sing the national anthem before the Wrigley Field audience, before games. So,
and a fun fact about Dwight Smith that I always thought was bullshit, but apparently it's true. And I don't know if the A's kept it or not, at Ho-Ho Cam, the main field was called Dwight Patterson Field, named after some donor, I think, who gave them money. One of the minor league fields was Dwight Smith Field. and it really was named after him. And I don't know if they thought it was funny because he had Dwight. I'm sure at some point, like, oh, it's Dwight Patterson Field of River. This one's Dwight Smith Field of River for the minor leaguers. But
yeah.
there was an actual field at Hohokam, and I don't know if it still is or not, because Hohokam's still a thing. It's just the Cubs just aren't there anymore.
The A's have it, yeah.
Dwight Smith Field. So now there's two guys that we would be remiss if we did not talk about. One of them, of course, was this was prime Hector Villanueva backup catcher territory.
Hector had a bad year in 92. He actually broke out in 91.
Yeah, so maybe we saved the bulk of that for 91.
But
one guy who cannot escape, because we'll never have any other chance to talk about him, Gary Scott.
Yep. All right, let's do this. Gary Scott.
He actually played more. He played more in both 91 and 92 than I remember.
Well, I'm sure he didn't play more than 40 games at the beginning of either season, and probably played 30 on each end at least or something.
Well, he only played 67 total. But I didn't know that he played – I didn't know he played that many games total for the Cubs.
So Gary Scott was a two-time opening day starter at third base. And the funny thing is, and we didn't even hardly mention his name when we talked about 1997, but like the same thing happened 5 years later when Kevin Orey came up 2 years in a row. He was our answer at third base. So Gary Scott was the first version. Kevin Orey was the second. But in the first version, it was the year before in 91. He gets the job out of spring training. Now, 91, the Cubs had high hopes. We'll talk about it when we talk about the season. But, you know, when you go around the field, you had some good players. You had Grace. You had Sandberg. You had Dunston before his injury. We didn't know that, you know, Jerome Walton was truly eating himself out of the league. Dawson was still in his prime. Third base, big mystery. But, you know, with all these veterans around, maybe you could bring this kid along. He had a big spring. He was terrible. But didn't stop them from trending again in 92. My lasting Gary Scott memory was a game that you can easily find on YouTube because I saw it a couple of years ago, was when he came to bat in a weeknight game at Wrigley Field early season, April, maybe May, against the Phillies.
The bases were loaded. April 20th.
You know the date? You know the 19, date?
I have the game pulled up.
Paul Abbott, who I only know that name because of this game. Kyle Abbott. Sorry, Paul was another pitcher who I think, if memory serves, justifiably walked off the mound and into Lake Michigan after the game because he could not put Gary Scott away. Gary Scott, weakening Gary Scott, base loaded situation. Kyle Abbott trying to get rid of him. Gary Scott fouls off like 15 pitches before he. I don't know if he put the grand slam into the basket or what, but it was Gary Scott's career highlight. No, he crushed it. Did he?
Okay. So here we go. So it was the Cubs were ahead 1-0 because Kyle Abbott, he actually gave up two home runs in this game. I don't know which one bothered him more. The first home run gave up to Greg Maddux. So the Cubs have a 1-0 lead in the fourth. And Mark Grace starts off with a single. Sandberg flies out to center. Hector strikes out looking. So he's about to get out of it. With Luis Salazar up, there was a wild pitch. Grace goes to second. He ends up walking Salazar in an 8-pitch at bat. Then he walks Doug DeCenzo on 4 pitches.
But it was a tiny strike zone. I mean,
but big deal, because here's Gary Scott, who came into the game hitting something. Because
right-handed hitter.
Even after his grand slam, he was hitting 121. So it was his batting average was not.
Well, I'm sure his OPS blew up, but
it was a 13 pitch at bat.
There it is,
and it says here. Now I don't know. Maybe the baseball reference guy being generous. Line drive to deep left field.
I'll give it to
Grace him. Scores. Salazar scores. DeCenzo scores. Scott scores. Cubs are up 5-0.
Yep. Just another exciting thing that happened in 1992.
They would go on to win 8-3 thanks to RBIs from Hector Villanueva and Luis Salazar late in the game.
And one of the 20 victories that Greg Maddux would have in his final season. Hector Villanueva did one thing that season. It was a game I was at. It might have been the only game I was at because I was in DeKalb year-round that year. I ran into my cousin who lives in DeKalb, and he's the guy that's had the season tickets that I been sitting in. He's had him since 85. I just ran into him at the American National Bank of DeKalb County on 4th Street, and he had these tickets on him and just gave them to me. And at the time they were five seats, and we were working at the Pistol. So Oleg was one of the guys that I was working with, another guy I worked with. Somebody had to have a car. We all, had a road trip into the city, and it was right after the Bulls had beaten the Blazers. You could probably find it. And the Cubs, it might've been Maddux and Tewksbury, but it was Tewksbury. We mentioned Tewksbury last week. He was sort of in his prime, his renaissance with the Cardinals, pitching well, and Villanueva was having a terrible year, but it was 1992. I was 20, but one of our buddies had just turned 21, and he was a big Cubs fan, and he was ragging on Villanueva because he was having a bad year. And I said, Hector's going to hit one out here. And he had a three-run bomb off of Tewksbury. And, of course, we were new to drinking at the park, or relatively, at least for a couple of years. And so Ron felt obligated to buy me a beer. So it's probably the first beer somebody bought me at Wrigley Field, thanks to Hector Villanueva.
Thanks to Hector.
Yeah.
Yeah, so coming into that game where he hit the Grand Slam, Gary Scott's slash line, this is a beaut, 103 batting average, 161 on-base percentage, 103 slugging.
Wow.
He had an OPS of 265 before he hit the grand slam of Kyle Abbott.
I bet you his teammate Frank Castillo had a higher OPS.
It's hard to have a lower OPS than
that's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another one that got wrong. You know, by then the Jim Fry farm system was just belching out like whatever crap. I mean, there was nothing. I mean, they drafted nothing.
He fired Gordon Goldsberry because he was a Dallas guy. And then the farm system. Do you know who the farm director was in 1992 for the Cubs?
Was it Al Goldis?
It was Bill Herford.
Remember that? I don't even know who that is.
And
I don't even know who that
about
is.
Right. The talent reflected the great Bill
Herford. Yeah. Jim Fry strangled the last remnants of vibrancy that Green had carefully cultivated. And then Larry Himes came in, ushering in the new blueprint, and was still shown the door because he was such an ass. It was when they found Andy McPhail, they found the perfect guy to run their mediocrity by design. That was tailor-made.
Do you know the Cubs had three pitchers double-digit wins that year? Do you know who the three were?
Yes, I do. Maddux won the Cy Young, and sort of as a rising tide carries all boats, seemed to elevate Mike Morgan to his career year. I want to say Morgan was 16-8, and I believe the Young and already in our two episodes, Frank Castillo. Yeah,
Frank's dominating the podcast so far. He is the crap.
I know.
He's the crap we're remembering.
And long after he's dead. Castillo debuted in 91, I believe, but he broke through. He had a nice season in 92. Part of the reason that they were, nominally alive, and they were, like we said, in late July, there was some pennant fever.
So the
lest we not forget.
Cubs won. The Cubs, 17 guys pitched for the Cubs that year. We just named those three that won 10 or more games. How many guys do you think won five or more games?
How many guys?
In addition to the three we have, how many other guys won at least five games?
I'm guessing you're fishing for low answers. I'm going to say two.
Out of 14.
Am I too high with two?
Yes, it was one. Sean Boskey was 5-11. Danny Jackson, 4-9. And then the only other four-game winner, hot shot youngster, Mike Harkey. 4-0 in seven starts.
Whoa! 2 years removed from being the third straight Cub to finish as runner of the year, runner up for rookie of the year.
4-0 with a 1.89 ERA.
So Danny Jackson was traded in July when he finally started winning games. He went like 1-6 his first year, and the first year of a big deal, and then he was finally started winning some games, and Larry Himes peddled him for Steve Buschel, who's basically settled into what any kid that grew up in the 90s would think of as the Cubs third baseman.
Well, yeah, with that curly blonde mullet.
And, I started getting confused around 95, 96 when we had Judd Bushler with the Bulls, and Steve Buschel, Judd Bushler, just trying to keep the name straight, just B-U-E-C-H.
Yeah, and that was straight up one-for-one trade. Danny Jackson for Steve Buschel.
And, Pittsburgh themselves had acquired Buschel at the trade deadline in 91 from Texas to bolster their run. I remember thinking the Cubs should try to get that Buschel, and they eventually did, but it was too little too late. He was, a guy. But he was probably had more starts at third base in the 90s than any Cub.
So Doug Strange played for the 92 Cubs.
I remember Doug Strange.
He had a robust 160. He would go on to play for the Rangers.
Trying Alex to make us forget
Arias, that. Remember him? He hit 293 for the Cubs in 99 at-bats.
Wow. Okay. Good for Alex.
He managed to have a higher on-base average than slugging. So good job. He did hit six doubles. Gary Scott, of course. Jerome Walton did not go out with a bang.
No.
Hit 127 for the Cubs. Only 55 at-bats. Then did he go to the Reds? Is that where he ended up?
He ended up with Atlanta with Dwight Smith in 95, I thought. I could be wrong, but I do remember that at one of the Cub convention gatherings at Shitty OK's, that both Dwight and Jerome had a booth. I got a fist bump from Dwight. I don't know what year that would have been during the Cubs convention.
Yeah, Jerome would go on to – he survived the whole season. I mean, he didn't play much. He went free agent, signed with the Angels, then the Reds, then the Braves, then the Orioles.
Did show up with the Braves, Yeah, and I don't know if it's unfair, but I just remember the impression at the time was that he kind of ate himself out of the league. He was rookie of the year in 1989. I think he won a gold glove. He had a 30-game hitting streak. Yep. I mean, the Cubs, we talked about it tonight, how, you know, the Cubs had a black hole for a long time at third base, but center field's been more laughable. They actually had a rookie of the year center fielder in that time. And 2 years after that, he was gone. 3 years, I should say. And Sean Boskey.
Huge trade in 1992. They traded Sed Landrum to the Brewers for Jeff Kunkel. Huge trade. Still, everybody remembers where they were on July 7th when the Cubs traded for Jeff Kunkel.
I do remember Sed Landrum. I want to say he wore number 28, but I could be wrong. He was a fleet-footed fella, Sed.
Yeah, and then all of our, many of our favorites were in the bullpen. Bob Scanlon.
Well, yeah, just to put one more observation.
Oh, go ahead.
Just to put one more observation on the season itself, because we kind of talked about, well, you know, the Cubs are kind of in contention, and even if we overrated that before Mike Ryko slapped us down, and like what drove them out? What I remember was that they didn't have a closer. Like I said, Jeff Robinson was taking a shot at it. Chuck McElroy, our guy, early in the season. I don't remember what happened, if he just became ineffective or hurt, but it was the other guy they got for Mitch Williams, Bob Scanlon, who LaFever was giving a shot as a closer down the stretch when the Cubs were still mathematically alive. It's one of those things where, you know, the guy saves a couple games and you're like, hey, here's our answer, right? And then you go into a game and it gets close, and he blows it, and then he blows like two more, and he's like, oh, you know, it's, you know, and they're all backbreaking games because they're in August and September. So I'm sure if you look, you'll see Scanlon, you know, probably had about three or four blown saves in August and September, and they were sort of big game. The Cubs are not a real contender. I know. I'm not, you know, harboring any illusions, but like I said, mediocrity by design. This was one of the years where things didn't go sideways. Things went, you know, not all correct, but they were sort of in contention. And Bob Scanlon and his absolute clothesline, straight as an arrow fastball, was unable to secure the deal for him.
So another great moment in Cubs history really happened that July when, now if I mention a Cub pitcher from that era and ears, who do you think?
Yeah, Jim Bollinger hitting a home run in his first major league
at bat.
Played appearance.
Not just the game. His first at bat. Coming out of the bullpen. Played appearance. Nonetheless.
Yeah, which, you know, and then 3 years later, he was their opening day starter in 95. And he was, that's right, Jim Bollinger, the game I talked to where Hector Villanueva hit a homer off of Bob Tewksbury right after the Bulls beat the Trailblazers in six games, Bollinger was like the pitcher or player of the week right around then. He had like five or six saves in a stretch. You can look that up if you had the chance. In 92, first couple weeks of June. You look shortly after he gets called up, hits a home run in a weird doubleheader makeup rain delay in St. Louis. And then within a week, the guy's saving games. So the guy with the big Dumbo errors was going to be, again, you know, if you want to point to why the team really, you know, on a micro level, why were they no good? They didn't really have a closer that was able to hold on to it, because obviously Bollinger wasn't able to continue, even though I'm pretty sure he was player or pitcher of the week one of those times.
So his home run was no joke. So he comes into a scoreless game to pitch in the fifth. And he leads off the top of the sixth off of the great
Real
Cormier.
Cormier.
And hits a home run to deep left field to give the Cubs a 1-0 lead. They would
it was a bomb.
They would cling to that lead until he gave it back. Oh, just in the bottom of the sixth. On a double to future Cub Todd Zeal. The Cubs go into extra innings. And they take Juan Augusto to the woodshed in the 13th.
Oh, former White Sox Juan Augusto.
He gives up RBI hits in consecutively to Jose Vizcaino, Ryan Sandberg, Andre Dawson, and Mark Grace. And the Cubs win the game 5-1.
Without
Bollinger's homer, they lose that game. So,
way to go, Jim. Yeah,
but he's the answer to lots of trivia questions. As for the longest time, who was the last Cub to hit a home run in his first at bat? And was Wilson the next guy to do it? Or was there somebody in between?
Soler did.
Jorge did too, in his first at bat?
Yeah, off of, who was that Lemonhead? He pitched for the Sox. It was Mike Leake, I think. And Javi Hilbert his first game, but not his first at bat.
Yep. Yeah, all the young guys made a splash in their first game.
Except for
Chris Bryant.
Ironically, right. He went forever before hitting homer.
And also, I think, the great James Shields, who proved his worth to the point where the White Sox had to trade Fernando Tatis Jr. for him. I think struck him out three times in his first Major League game. First home game.
It may have been three, it may have been four. It may have gotten a sombrero. And then the next time he was 0-2, his first time up, coaxed a walk. And, yeah.
I believe he also, in his very first game as a pro for the Cubs in Eugene, Oregon, Bryant struck out. He might have struck out five times in his first game.
Oh.
It's like, oh, the guy's a bust. What the hell are we doing? And he got a little better after that. So,
I wonder who struck out the most on the 92 Cubs.
Oh,
It would have been Sosa had he stayed healthy, no doubt. And I'm going to say, Sandberg was actually a high strikeout guy. He played a lot of, he was always healthy.
The leading strikeouter for the Cubs that year struck out 73 times.
So not that much.
It's because Sammy only played.
And it was still Sammy?
It was not Sammy, but Sammy was close. Sammy was third.
Oh.
Sammy struck out 63 times in 67 games.
67 games?
It was Sandberg with 73. Dawson struck out 70 times.
Yeah.
Rick Wilkins, pretty much very Sammy-esque, 53 strikeouts in 274 plate appearances.
Yep.
Bouchel didn't even play the whole year for them, and he struck out 44 times in 65 games.
Yes, but he also hit for the cycle. So.
Then you got to go way down to ninth, and you get Mark Grace.
Yeah.
36 strikeouts, 72 walks.
Wow. Playing every damn day.
He's
pretty
walked
good.
Twice as much as he struck out. 689 plate appearances. Yeah.
You know, individually, there's some good players on that team when you look at it. Dawson was old. Like I said, it was Sandberg's last full complete season. Grace had sort of, bounced back. Sosa was mostly just promise. Dunson got hurt. I don't know. I mean, they were mediocre, but they weren't terrible. And we were in our 20s, so.
Yeah, you talked about the uncertainty at closer. While they only had four pitchers with 10 or more, with five or more wins, which is just amazing. They had four guys who had at least six saves.
Wow.
So can you name them? I believe we've mentioned every one of them so far.
Bollinger, McElroy, Scanlon?
Yep, and one more.
Holy moly. But he's already been mentioned.
Yep. Think droopy left-hander.
Oh, Ostenmacher.
Paul Ostenmacher. He had eight.
Okay.
Yep.
Scanlon
led the team with 14. Bollinger had seven. McElroy six.
Okay.
And Ostenmacher eight.
So, that was my memory is correct. Scanlon was basically the guy they rode down the stretch.
Let Jesse Hollins do it?
Remember Jesse Hollins?
Jeff Hartsock.
Wait, Jesse Hollins made it to the bid. He got called up. He was on that team.
He was 22 years old.
I had no idea, dude. I followed the Cubs closely. I always thought he was a guy I read about in the minors, and he pissed off Larry Himes or something. Wow, Jesse Hollins.
And I can't remember. Jeff Robinson pitched in 49 games, and I, honest to God, didn't remember any of that.
Do you remember Jeff Robinson? He used to be a Pittsburgh Pirate.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I remember him as a Giant.
Blonde hair, dude. Yeah, somehow, like I said, we referenced that epic Pittsburgh series that we all inflated in late July that began with Maddox outdueling Drabek. I remember Jeff Robinson came on for his first save of the season.
Yeah, he had a very serviceable year. Bullpen ERAs are always a little ugh, but he had a 3 ERA, 3 on the dot. He only had 76 hits in 78 innings. He had ERA plus of 121, and he was so excited about it that he retired.
He never pitched again?
He's like, fuck it, I'm done.
How old was he?
31.
So we both remember him from the Giants.
I wonder if he got hurt.
I wonder.
He re-signed for 93, but then didn't. And maybe he got, I don't know, if he got cut.
Could have gotten cut.
Or he just said, I don't want to pitch for you.
Oh, and then one last thing we already mentioned, but I saw somebody make reference today that it was the 1992 spring training when the Cubs cut Moyer and offered him a coaching job, supposedly. He said no thanks, and then it still took him a few years to reappear. Right. It's a little bit disingenuous when you rag on Jim Fry for trading Moyer and Palmeiro, two big stat compilers for Mitch Williams and whatever else they got, because Moyer did nothing for Texas, was basically pitched himself out of baseball and refound himself. But he did come back to the Cubs in 92 and couldn't make the team.
Yeah, he didn't pitch. Moyer only made 7 starts in 91 for the Cardinals. It was 0-5 with a 574. Didn't pitch at all in 92. And that's when he reinvented himself. And he went to the Orioles started. Well, he won 12 games.
Started turning
was
around.
Not good in 94. That was that was the strike go home early year.
Yeah.
He had a 4.7 ERA. So really, the Orioles are probably the team that looks at it and says, the hell we give him up for? Because he pitched for them in 95, left, and then split time in 96 between the Red Sox and the Mariners, where he really became Jim Moyer.
Uh-huh.
But he was that year, 96, he was 13-3.
Yeah.
And then he won 17, 15, 14, 13, 20, 13, and 21 over the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, he came up with Maddox in 86. Because I was an idiot, I thought Moyer was better because he had a better one-loss record. He was 11-7, and Maddox was 6-14. And I read some Jerome Holtzman article when he's interviewing Big Dick Pohl, Cubs pitching coach, and Pohl was saying that Maddox is going to be a future Hall of Famer. He was saying Maddox is the guy that's going to be great. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about, Dick Pohl? Jamie Moyer's the guy. But they were right, obviously, even when Maddox was struggling.
Jamie Moyer led his league, depending on where team he was on, in stats 3 different times. One of them for the Cubs. Do you know in 1987 what he did more of than any other National League pitcher that year?
I'm going to guess home runs.
Nope. He gave up the most runs in the National League, 114.
Okay.
He had a 5.10 ERA. In 96, he led the American League with an 8.13 winning percentage. But then in 2004, he led the American League. He gave up 44 homers. Sure. Didn't Bert Blyleven give up? He gave up 50 in a season once, right?
Blyleven, did he hit 50? He set the record in the 80s. Has it never been broken? I don't know.
I think Steve Draxel gave up more than 50 that one year just to mark
me off.
Yeah, Blyleven in 1986. Led the American League in innings pitched with 271 and 2/3 and home runs with 50. He returned the next season to give up 46. Wow. And in those two seasons, he was 32-26 with a 4.01 ERA.
So it's impressive he still holds the single season. He obviously must hold the double season, but the fact this was pre any juice balls, steroids, all that other stuff. And now that the numbers have sort of been suppressed a little bit, good old Bert will be holding on to that mark for a good while, I'm thinking.
So, yeah, the two weird stats was that Jim Palmer never gave up a grand slam, and Bert Blyleven gave up 50 homers in a season.
I'm going to give you one, too, then. You said grand slam. Sammy Sosa never hit a grand slam at Wrigley Field.
He also only hit two for the Cubs ever, right? And they were in back-to-back games?
No, he ended up hitting about seven or eight.
Oh,
he hit,
well, yeah,
he hit, right. Yeah.
But his first two, he had the longest stretch before he hit one.
Yes.
And then
yes.
hit one the very next day.
He had almost set the mark for like most games and
home
runs.
Where was the first one? The second one was in Arizona.
They're both in Arizona.
Oh, so back-to-back games in Arizona.
I'm pretty sure. And then he hit a third one in San Diego in September, and he ended up hitting about seven or eight. They're all on the road because every time his bases would get loaded, everybody's going to stand up. It put the pressure on him, and Sammy was showing
swing
him
at anything.
He's going to swing the, just squeeze the hell out of the bat and never do it. So that's it.
All right.
So,
well, that's your 1992 Cubs.
I feel good about that.
It was funny because I was so confident about the Gary Scott. I'm like, oh, we got to talk about Gary Scott. This was when he hit the Grand Slam. And then I pulled the stats. I'm like, oh, shit, what if he hit it in 91? But he didn't hit it in 91.
I knew it was 92. I was in my apartment.
That's why I was shocked to see that he'd played in 31 games the year before. I knew he'd been up to start the season. I thought they cut bait really fast then. And I knew that the 92, it was, all right, this is it, buddy. This is your last chance. And they gave him probably an extra 10 games just because. And then
he performed
well.
And I got to think he performed worse because those numbers you pulled were from 92, I believe. So
well, we can finish with this. It's two seasons of excellence, really.
Yeah. It's almost, it's like.
I don't want to say that I could duplicate what a major leaguer did, but I think in 1991 and 1992, I think I might have come close.
Depends on if you're willing to lean into one like Ray Sanchez did with Rob Dibble.
Yeah, I'm Rudy Stein from the original Bad News Bears. I'll lean into anything. So in two seasons, he played 67 total games, and he hit 160 with a 250 on base, Corey Patterson-esque, and a 240 slugging percentage. He had 42 total bases in 67 games. That, kids, if you wonder, that's really bad.
Wow.
He was a second-round draft pick out of – do you know where he went to school when he went to college?
Yes, Villanova. Villanova. I remember that.
Him and Matt Caesar, the greatest players in Villanova history.
Oh, that's right.
As far as anybody knows. All right, well, let's play this game then. Who got drafted after Gary Scott?
What year?
Here's a good one. This was 1989.
Well, I'm pretty sure Earl Cunningham got drafted before him, as did Frank Thomas. Well, was he a first round pick?
No, he's second round pick. So this is harder. But
he was a good
player. There's some good names on here. There is the father of a recent National League Most Valuable Player.
Father of a recent National League.
Six spots after Gary Scott. He had a decent career for himself. Not decent. He was okay. He was bad. But he played for, amongst other teams, the Yankees. He was a shortstop.
And his
guy. Yes, and his son plays for the Dodgers.
Oh, Bellinger.
Yes, Clay Bellinger picked just behind him. Andy Fox got picked right behind him, future big leaguer.
Oh, Andy Fox.
That's a bad one. It's just the two. Let's see who the Cubs took in the first round.
Let's see who Jim Frey was burning the system down to the ground with.
Oh, yes. There's some Cubs on this list, though. Just not guys that got
drafted by the Cubs.
Number one overall, Ben McDonald for the Orioles.
1989. Okay.
Future Cub. The number two pick in the whole draft.
Todd Van Poppel, though.
Tyler Houston.
Wow. What a buster. Who drafted him? Atlanta?
Yep. The Barbs.
Okay.
Then Roger Salkeld, Jeff Jackson, who didn't ever make it to the big leagues. Donald Harris, who might as well not have. And then Paul Coleman, and then some guy that whatever happened to him, he does testosterone commercials now, Frank Thomas, the seventh pick, followed by Cub immortal Earl Cunningham.
So that was 2 years in a row. The Cubs went, one year they went right before the Sox, because before is when they took
the Frank Thomas one. There's nothing you can do about that. You can't control who gets picked before.
But passing on Ventura
Ty Griffin, Rob Ventura, that's the one that hurts. Oh, here, to bring it full circle, guess who got picked after Earl Cunningham? Gary Scott's favorite pitcher.
No. Oh, Abbott?
Kyle Abbott.
Oh, terrific. Terrific.
Charles Johnson went 10th to the Expos.
Okay.
Must not have signed, right? Because then he got drafted again by the
Marlins. By the Marlins. He was like their first ever pick.
Did Calvin Murray ever play for the Cubs? I feel like he did.
I think he did.
Okay, so he
center
was,
field.
He was the 11th pick for the Indians. Jeff Jeudon.
Oh,
the Astros. Jeff Jeudon.
Yeah, I've got a funny Jeff Jeudon story that I'll save for when we do 1996.
Let's see. Cal Eldred went to the Brewers, 17th. Future Cub Willie Green.
Future White Sox.
Got picked by the Pirates.
Yeah. The remember the pick. Who could forget the Willie Green and Shane Andrews dynamic duo at third base in the 2000 season? We'll get to that when we talk about 2000.
22nd pick in the draft. Future Cub Tom Goodwin.
Another sort of nondescript center fielder like Calvin Murray. Cubs had them both.
One pick ahead of Mo Vaughn. Oof. The Dodgers probably wish they could have had that one over again. Alan Zinter for the Mets. And then here's pretty good value. 25th pick in the draft by the Twins, Chuck Knobloch.
Okay.
Here's a great one. A future Chicago Bull was the 26th pick in the draft.
A future Chicago Bull? Was it
three NBA championships for the Bulls.
Scott Williams?
No, but you got half the name right.
Scott Burrell?
Yep. He was,
I think Burrell only won title number six. I don't think he was on all three of the finals.
No. Yeah, but he certainly was on The Last Dance because.
Well, yeah, he was.
When I had Kelly on the podcast, he talked about how one of the reasons, and they didn't really get into the documentary, one of the reasons that Jordan picked on Burrell so much was Burrell gave him shit one time about how much better baseball player he was than Jordan was. Oh, and Jordan didn't believe it. And then somebody had to tell him that he was a first round draft pick in baseball.
That ties back into this. You just pointed it out. He was drafted in 89. Wow. That's wow.
Actually, one last thing before we go. This is something we should probably do every time. We should probably look at who they picked that year.
Can I guess?
About 92.
I think he was brought up last week because I think he was who they traded for Brian McCray. Would it have been Derek? Is it Derek? What's his name? Derek Wallace? Was that Larry Himes' first pick? I don't know why I can't commit him to memory. I know he drafted Kieschnick in 93.
Derek Wallace.
It was Derek Wallace.
The 11th pick.
All right, let's follow it. Derek Wallace became, as we learned last time, Brian McCray, who became, you know, parts
the one
of
dog,
Manny Alexander.
Mark Clark.
I think the line died there. I don't think we got anything for those guys. I'm still going to dwell on the fact that we end up with Larry Lubbers for Rafael Palmeiro.
This was not a good draft, except for one notable exception.
1992 draft? Jeez.
First pick was Phil Nevin.
Yeah, wow.
And I can tell the story now because he's not with the Cubs anymore. So a few years ago, my in-laws lived in Arizona. We were going to be in Arizona for spring training. So I called Len Casper, and Len took my wife and me out for dinner.
I remember that. You wrote about it, a little bit.
And Barry doesn't know anything about my wife, Barry, doesn't know anything about baseball, really. But she really liked Len because he's such a nice guy and easy to talk to. And so she just asked him, first she asked him, like, who's your favorite guy that you've ever, like, covered in baseball? And I don't even remember who he said, but I distinctly remember then when she asked him who his least favorite guy was. And he looked at me and he goes, you can't write this. I said, I won't. He goes, it's Phil Nevin. With just disgust. It was great.
I had heard, you know, even like above ground reports that Nevin was a bit of a cantankerous
prick. The only good thing Phil ever did for the Cubs was he traded himself.
Yes, because that was the stage of the Henry era where guys did that.
Yep. So Phil Nevin was the number one pick. Remember Paul Shuey, closer for the Indians?
Did he die in the boat accident?
No, he wasn't one of those.
Okay, guys. Sorry.
Somebody named B.J. Wallace went third for the Expos, did not play in the big leagues. Hmm. Then Jeffrey Hammonds, the Orioles. Chad Matola, to the Reds. And then this next guy turned out okay. Derek Jeter, to the Yankees. He was sixth pick.
Yeah.
Calvin Murray got picked again.
Oh,
Calvin liked to get drafted. Pete Janicki for the Angels. And then guys that we heard of. Preston Wilson got picked by the Mets. Future Cub Michael Tucker Royals right before Derek Wallace.
Mm-hmm. Hit a grand slam against the Cubs in the playoffs.
Ken Felder to the Brewers. Didn't make it to the big leagues. Chad McConnell to the Phillies. Fielder.
Okay.
Yeah. Was he Tiny Felder? That wasn't. That was something.
No, I don't. Not at all. No, I don't. I don't recall the name.
Ron Valone pitched for the Cubs, right?
Ron Valone pitched against the Cubs as a member of the Houston Astros and right. seemed to frustrate him like every soft tossing lefty.
He was bad, so it felt like he pitched for the Cubs.
No, I don't think he ever made his way to the Cubs.
Pretty all sure. right. See other notables: Shannon Stewart to the Blue Jays at 19.
Yeah.
Rick Helling to the Rangers at 22. Future Cub Homer. Jason Kendall. To the Pirates at 23.
How about that?
And okay. I think we've run out of. Oh, and Johnny yeah, not... Damon.
Okay. So Damon.
We know got... can't handle his liquor.
That's right. That's right.
Royals, yeah. the 35th pick.
So Hall of Famer and Jeter hit some good players. You know, baseball drafts are weird. You're always going to see guys you never heard of, guys that became obscure, mediocre players that. Would inevitably play for the Cubs. And then, yeah, you'll get some. I mean, obviously, your best players were, I think, I mean, Bonds and Griffey, they're all first-round guys, but throughout the course of the first 30 picks, you just – that's certainly true for the Cubs, Derek Wallace.
Yeah, well, a quick look at their entire draft. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the 50 guys they picked – played at least one game in the big leagues. It's not a great percentage.
Oh, my God.
Especially when one was 12%. Derek Wallace. The best player they drafted that year, at least for them. Yeah, for anybody. Brant Brown.
Okay.
The 11th pick of the third round.
And he was the best player.
Yes. And Mike Hubbard was the 8th round pick. Kenny Steenstra was the 11th rounder or 12th round pick.
And then hopes and for that's Stenny. It.
There is nothing.
Wait, who was the guy that you just mentioned? Brant Brown. Okay.
Mike Hubbard, backup catcher.
Yeah, Brant Brown did yield. So something came out of that because, you know, we'll cover the John Lieber years when we spin the wheel on it.
They drafted another Pico, Brandon. I wonder if he's Jeff Pico's brother.
I wonder if his wife also married a ball player. Because wasn't Mark Grace's ex-wife, sister-in-law, Jeff, your sister, Jeff Pico's wife, I believe.
I think
they grew up in Peoria. I think they're two girls that married ball players. So one divorced Grace married Ray Liotta. One stayed married to Jeff Pico. No word on his brother.
Jeff Pico for one game was the greatest Cub pitcher of all time.
He threw a second shutout later that year too.
Right. Though. But I say if he retired after his first game.
Yes. People like you and me, what's the first thing you think of? Right. Threw a shutout in his first. I think he was also kind of a useful bullpen guy in 89, too. So another Dallas Green draft pick. Yep. We'll come to that later.
All right. Well, what do we got? Two down and 30 to go.
Something like that. I mean, I know we bleed into other years, but for the most part, I think we picked off all the high points of 92. I'm just glad I got the Cale Daniels in there.
Yeah, we mostly stuck to 92. We alluded to other years.
It's going to happen. Yeah. You know, we talk about eras, we talk about where the organization was, you know, more of the sort of broader tectonic, you know, movement.
Well, and for full transparency, we didn't have to do it because we hit 92 this year. We have an internal rule that at least until the end, in case we run out of and we can't do it, that like, so last two weeks ago, we did 97, which meant if we had spun the wheel and hit 96 or 98, we would have respun because those are just too close together. But we hit 92. So next week, we can guarantee, or whenever we do this, 2 weeks, we can guarantee you that it will not be 91 or 93.
Right. And I think we talked plenty about 91 anyway, but we'll give it the full treatment whenever it comes up weeks down the road. And same goes for 93. So it'll be fun. It'll be fun to have if it lands on the 80s. We've covered two eras that were in that second Tribune era of design and mediocrity by design. So, you know, it'd be nice if you know, just to mix it up if it falls. But either way, I don't know. I had fun doing this still. I don't think it gets old, but either way.
The saddest thing about your theory of this mediocrity by design, which I believe, is that it's happening right now.
Again. It is. I know it is. I know it is. It's a new chapter. Yeah. I know. Even worse, because the ones
they weren't getting rid of good players at that time. They just decided
they would never
gonna
get rid of Grace or Sosa or Sandberg. You know,
under the Tribune theory, Anthony Rizzo would have been signed last year. He wouldn't even gotten to his walk year. They would have signed him. Yeah. And they probably would have tried to sign Javi. And Bryant is a guy they probably would have let go because he would have wanted to be paid what he's worth.
Correct. He would have been,
no, we're not doing
He would have been the Maddox.
But
absolutely.
Their whole thing would have been, we've got to pick one or two of these guys that the fans love.
Right.
And then the rest of the team can be shit. But you've got Javi and Rizzo.
Right. There's
what
that
more could you ask for?
There's that McDonough element that was sort of in the shadows through both, you know, even from the Dallas Green era that helped drive that engine. And you're right. They're walking away from Rizzo. That's one difference. But
yeah,
I have thought about that. They've returned to that.
Right. And they don't have a McDonough-like guy. They've got Crane, whose bonus is probably tied to how much money they can save off the payroll. Right. So he's happy to advocate to dump all these guys. Well, won't this affect TV ratings? Well, TV ratings suck anyway, so who cares?
I just picture a room of people where Ryan Dempster is doing stand-up, and the only two people laughing are Crane and Todd Ricketts, and they're laughing hysterically.
Doing the weird thing where people who clap with their hands, like, both straight up when they clap.
Just going nuts in their seats.
Oh, he's a stitch.
So.
All right.
In time.
Well, until next time, when we spin it again.
Works for me. Happy opening day.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Andy.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Many of us have herpes.